Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So I think it has to be referred to, surely, as a ménage à trois, because it's a promise of future entertainment and enjoyment that nobody's quite sure is going to satisfy all three. The submarine element is the most proximate element, but it shouldn't be the most important. The most important bit should be cooperation on things like quantum and AI, on drones and on, you know, future technologies.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College, with support from policyforum.net. In this episode of our Security Summit series, Professor Rory Medcalf interviews Tom Tugendhat MP, Chair of the UK Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee. A decorated veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan, Tom helped set up Afghanistan's National Security Council and made global headlines recently with a powerful speech deploring the withdrawal from Kabul. He is a prominent voice in Britain's stance on China and the future of the Indo-Pacific, and he's welcomed the new AUKUS arrangement. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging.
So welcome to the National Security Podcast. It's a great pleasure to welcome Tom Tugendhat to the podcast. Tom, if I can address you by first name, your interest in national security ranges from Britain's interests in the world to, I guess, as I see it, the fate of liberal democratic order internationally. And of course, now there's a very, very strong Indo-Pacific component, a very relevant Australia focus in the way I think Britain and you see the world. I'd like to invite you to a pretty wide-ranging conversation around these issues. And if you don't mind, I'd like to begin actually with Afghanistan, because you've been a very prominent voice, critical of not only the withdrawal from Afghanistan, but the way, the really disastrous way in which that unfolded. And your views, your words, the way you've articulated that, I think resonated internationally, including in Australia. But it would be really useful to get a sense from you on what next, because the withdrawal has happened. It's a tragedy at so many levels, and yet the liberal international order, democracies like Australia and the UK, have to make some hard choices about where we go from here. What are your thoughts?
Well, look, I think the fundamental thing to remember in Afghanistan is, from our perspective now, it's over on one level. We're not players there anymore. We're not, the influence that we try to have over the Taliban will frankly be minor, if any. And so we need to look at what our interests are in the region and stop trying to, influence Kabul, and instead look at where we care about, which is, of course, countries like Pakistan, India, Iran, those areas of the world where we're really facing different challenges, and challenges by because of the living bridge between our communities, challenges because of, the instability that the government may bring, and challenges that affect the whole world because of the energy and resource constraints that those administrations may bring about. So I think we've got to move away, in a funny way, from Afghanistan. I say that, with a heavy heart, having spent so much of my own life there. But I think we've got to move away from Afghanistan and focus on what's fundamentally in the interest of the British people, sorry, and Australian people, obviously.
What about the connection of the circumstances of withdrawal, the really awful spectacle of that, for credibility of democracies, for credibility of the United States as a leader, for credibility of Britain, Australia, European partners as allies and actors in favour of a rules-based order. I mean, we can say it's over, but of course it's not over for our credibility and our choices in the world going forward. And of course, there are countries like India that now have a changed strategic landscape as a consequence. So I would push you on that a little bit and ask, how can we maybe not learn the lessons, but how can we salvage something from this situation?
Sorry, you're absolutely right. It's, we will live with the reputation that we wrote ourselves, and that reputation will be affected by what is a defeat. There's no point in dressing it up. The West was, the United States, NATO was defeated in Afghanistan in 2021. Now, you can put a whole series of explanations if you like. You can put the timeline that President Obama set. You can put the instrument of surrender that President Trump signed. You can put the method of withdrawal, or that President Biden ordered. All of these are true. But the reality remains that the government in Afghanistan today is the Taliban. And that's not what we chose. Therefore, however you dress it up, it's a defeat. But you're right in that it's not over, in the sense that the reputational damage will live on. And I don't know if but a few days after the chaos in Kabul, the Chinese government was putting out messages in Taiwan highlighting the fact that these are the allies that the Taiwanese people are relying on. Now, it's pretty crude propaganda, and Taiwan is not the same as Afghanistan, and there's many other differences, but you can see it's a propaganda message that they're trying to use, and countries like India and Pakistan, and indeed many countries in sub-Saharan Africa, are also looking at this and seeing, hang on a minute, what does an alliance look like, and what's reliable and what's not? So, I think it is certainly a reputational issue that we're going to have to manage, and that's why there's various different levels of things that I think we need to be doing quickly. One of them, we'll come to it, I'm sure, is the AUKUS deal, the Australia UK-US deal, which demonstrates a commitment to allies. But I think we all need to do more with others too, because sticking together as the three of us isn't enough.
We'll move to AUKUS fairly soon, but I really want to move from, the withdrawal from Afghanistan to the what is stated in the US policy debate as the major reason for that withdrawal. And it's not just that this was, as has been called, a forever war or a very long conflict for the United States, but it's because of the strategic challenges globally, and especially the rise of China's coercive power, the China challenge to the United States. That's the message that we're getting, that somehow the US felt the need to withdraw from Afghanistan to demonstrate that it could step up in the Indo-Pacific. Now, this may or may not be the whole story, but it's certainly the simple narrative we hear, that a lot of this is about the Biden administration now doubling down on competing with China. Is that how it's viewed in Britain?
Well, look, I can understand the logic of the White House in saying, our main effort is the China challenge, and therefore we're, as various electoral strategists put it, we're knocking the barnacles off the boat in order to focus on the main event. I understand that logic. I would argue that Afghanistan, both in strategic terms and in resource terms, it's more than a barnacle on the boat. It actually has an effect on regional influence. It has an effect on the different ways in which China is trying to influence the world, and it also demonstrates, as we just said, an intent, a strategic commitment that is harder to demonstrate now. So, I get why they did it, and I think their focus on China, not as not in itself, but as an autocratic player that is challenging democracies in a very fundamental way, I mean, I understand why they do that. And as you know, it's something that I've written and spoken about an awful lot, because I do think we need to wake up.
Let's say that China is becoming the main game strategically. And I know that we could have a conversation, especially from your geographic vantage point, about Russia in that regard, and perhaps China and Russia as different kinds of autocracies and the challenges they pose. But let's focus on China, if I may. As you know, in the Australian national security debate, the Australian policy debate generally over the past 5 years, we've gone through a really extraordinary reality check on China, to the point now where, for example, just a fortnight ago, the Australian Treasurer, when given the opportunity to give a grand speech on basically anything, chose to focus not on a traditional Treasurer's prosperity agenda, but on how to protect Australia from economic coercion from China. It was a national security speech. And that's just one emblem of where we're at in our debate. Of course, in defence and military posture, there's the AUKUS deal that we're going to get to. Australia's had its China reality check, but it seems to me that Britain's gone through a reality check on China in recent years as well, where, you know, the balance of looking at China either as a source of opportunity or as, if you like, a place of risk has shifted. Can you illuminate that debate?
Sure. I mean, when I was first elected in 2015, we were in the so-called golden era that had been declared between Chairman Xi and Prime Minister Cameron. And the idea was that, you know, Britain was China's best ally in Europe, you know, main marketplace for everything from renminbi bonds to, you know, capital. Anyway, it was a very deliberate strategy by the UK government to get close to Beijing and to stay close. That changed, and it changed for me at various points when I was elected chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in 2017, and then over recent years, culminating in, as you may know, I've been sanctioned by the Communist Party of Beijing for speaking out on human rights, you know, which is pretty extraordinary, because Britain and other countries have sanctioned Chinese officials for violating the human rights of Chinese citizens, and China has sanctioned people for defending the human rights of Chinese citizens. It's a pretty extraordinary situation to find yourself in. And that relationship has degraded, but it's not just sort of personally, it's degraded institutionally as well. You know, the reality is that the Huawei debate that I was alone in calling for changes to our relationship to Huawei in 2016, and I was considered, frankly, a bit far out when I pointed out that making the spinal cord of your entire nervous system from the parts built in a semi-hostile, at that point, and certainly autocratic state, may not be the best long-term investment. It did feel to me a bit like we were building the house on sand. You know, as I say, in 2016, that was a pretty unusual position to take. By 2019, you know, we'd won the debate, we'd won some votes. I mean, there are still people in the British government, including the Prime Minister, who describe themselves as Sinophiles, and still, I think, try to balance that relationship. But I think the debate has largely moved on in the sense that people are aware, as the Speaker of the House demonstrated when he refused to allow the Chinese ambassador to speak in Parliament, or rather to attend an event in Parliament. People realize that, you know, we're dealing with a hostile and aggressive state that is seeking to silence democracy and change the way in which we live our lives. So I think that relationship has moved on to what I would say is a sad but more honest reality.
So there were clearly some turning points there. I mean, that's a pretty profound shift, more than a pivot, in the last few years. In the Australian case, you know, we had some very specific episodes of media revelations of foreign influence or interference activities. We had, you know, more recently, of course, the very active and continuing and open economic coercion against Australia. We've got our own proximity to the South Pacific, where we've got concerns about China seeking a security presence. You know, we're unquestionably an Indo-Pacific country in a region where China's seeking military dominance, particularly in the South China Sea. So in some ways, it's more understandable in the Australian context that there's been this this wake-up on China as a place of risk. At one level, it may seem a little bit surprising that it's happened in Britain. At another level, you know, we might ask the question, why did it take so long? Can you explain that paradox?
Sure. I mean, look, you know, in many ways, China is a long way away. I mean, actually, if you look at the western border of China and its proximity to the UK, it's not that dissimilar from the distance between Australia and Beijing. But the impression of geography and the reality, as you know, are not identical. And the impression is that China is further away and it's in your area, not in ours. So I think for a lot of people, for many years, it was not considered particularly relevant. I think a few decisions by the Chinese state changed that. One was bullying Australia, frankly. It was pretty sobering. I mean, there's very few people in the UK who think ill of Australia. You know, whatever you think of Australia, whatever you think of, you know, Australian culture or economics or education or anything.
Or cricket.
We think pretty negatively about cricket, that's true. But we're terrified of Australian cricket. So the reality is that the relationship between Australia and the UK, certainly from UK eyes, is extremely positive. You know, if people are asked which countries they hold in esteem, and which countries they respect, which countries they may wish to move to or go on holiday to, Australia is always in the top few, right? And so to see Australia being bullied so aggressively by Beijing was a real wake-up call for many people, I think. And, it certainly inspired many of us to stock up on Freedom Wine, which I hope has done some good for the Australian economy. And it certainly has made a lot of people increasingly aware that this is, you know, this we're all in this together. But there is another element, which is, I don't know how much this has been followed in Australia, but in Europe, the wolf warrior diplomacy has been particularly aggressive. Countries like the Czech Republic and Sweden, again, two countries that, you know, very few people have negative views about. I mean, these are, you know, very close allies, very close friends. And, you know, the Swedish migration into the UK is not something I've ever heard any protests about. I mean, you know, this is a country that is considered extremely positively, even if you're not a fan of ABBA. And to have the Chinese ambassador to Stockholm saying to the Swedish people that for our friends we have wine and flowers and for our enemies we have shotguns is, you know, it's pretty sobering. If you're threatening the Swedes, if you're threatening the Australians, if you're threatening the Czechs.
Well, and the Lithuanians this week, I think.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, the latest one, and I've been speaking to Foreign Minister Landsbergis about this and others, is to see, you know, Lithuania, a country that frankly knows the price of tyranny all too well, knows the cost of occupation, knows what dictatorship looks like, is effectively being bullied by the Chinese state over what it calls a representative office in Taiwan. I mean, frankly, it's none of China's business what it calls. I mean, you can call it Juliet for all anybody's business. I mean, you know, and the Chinese state has got extremely hostile about it and is seeking to use similar tactics, not quite the same, of course, but similar tactics to the ones used on Australia in order to force capitulation by the Lithuanian state. And, you know, this is a small country. So I have to say, I'm in huge admiration of the Lithuanian people in demonstrating the integrity to stand up for the principles of freedom and autonomy that they quite rightly embody.
These issues, at one level, are about geography. I mean, let's face it, if you're Japan or India or the Philippines or Vietnam or Taiwan, there's a very clear issue of proximity to China and bullying over territory, for example, that's at the fore of this. But if you're in Britain or if in any of the other democracies at a distance that are beginning to form some sort of solidarity and concern about Chinese power, it's not primarily about geography and proximity. It's about something else. And it seems to me that parliamentarians have played a pretty major role in this. I mean, there's, for instance, the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China, which a number of Australian parliamentarians and British parliamentarians are in. And there's also, if you like, groups that have formed in various parliaments informally to make China an issue. How does that work and what's your involvement?
So I set up the China Research Group about a year and a bit ago, what is it, nearly 2 years, year and a half ago, in order to better understand what's going on in China. And the purpose of the group is to, you know, read Chairman Xi's speeches to understand the economic drivers, to look at the different pressures on provincial governors and so on. Because the level of understanding of Chinese politics is extremely low. I mean, if you were to ask British or many parliamentarians from around the world who the US foreign minister was, you'd have a pretty good chance of getting the right answer. The same is true of Australia or the UK, or maybe it'd take a few days to catch up if we've just got a new one. But you know what I mean? You'd have a reasonably good chance. Whereas in many countries, it would be unusual to get the right answer for Wang Yi. And just, I mean, this is pretty basic, but just basic understanding of what's going on in China, what's changing and what's coming next, I think is something that has become an increasing issue. Because, you know, you quite rightly spoke about proximity, and I understand your point entirely. And it's certainly true that countries that are proximate to China are facing greater pressure in various different ways. But the reality is China's policies aren't regional, they're global. And you can see this by the way that Beijing is seeking to influence UN agencies, such as the International Telecoms Union. You can see this by the way in which pressure is being put on the World Health Organization, for example, to seek to silence some of the criticism, or at least some of the inquiry into the origins of the coronavirus. You can see how China's global reach is changing the way in which the rules work for all of us. And therefore, yes, of course, proximity is a factor, but it's not the only factor. And understanding how Beijing's policies are seeking to influence the outcome and affect the prosperity of the British people, I think is important for British parliamentarians, even though we are, as you quite rightly say, a long way away.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So let's move to the main topic of this conversation, certainly for Australian listeners, and I suspect internationally, and that is the extraordinary news of the past week, the announcement of AUKUS, the Australia, UK, United States arrangement. I'm not quite sure what we should term it. It's not quite an alliance. It's not formally a treaty at this stage, but it's a pretty striking alignment, if you like, in international affairs. And just to recap that for listeners, of course, that is the grand announcement by the leaders of the three countries that there will be a deep alignment of cooperation on military technology, on new and emerging and critical technologies like cyber and quantum computing and undersea detection, with an early objective of beginning cooperation to help Australia acquire nuclear-powered submarines for its defence in contested Indo-Pacific region. And there's no doubt in my mind that there's a China context to that big announcement. Many ripples, including as we may get to the you know, the consequences for France, which is, to say the least, disappointed at losing a major submarine building contract with Australia. But this is a momentous development. How do you read the arrival of the AUKUS arrangement?
So I think, you know, it has to be referred to surely as a ménage à trois. I mean, isn't that what it really is? Because it's a promise of future entertainment and enjoyment that nobody's quite sure is going to satisfy all three. But you know, let's see what it delivers. Because the submarine element is it's the most proximate element, but it's not. It shouldn't be the most important bit. The most important bit should be cooperation on things like quantum and AI, on drones and on, you know, future technologies. So let's see where we get with that. I think that's hugely important. And by the way, this AUKUS menage has proved hugely popular in the UK, quite understandably, for exactly the same reasons as we were speaking about earlier, that Australia is seen extremely positively from Westminster and actually from the whole of the British Isles. And you know, the relationship with the United States is seen as an important one. So I think on all levels, this is a positive move. And in 2016, I was last in Australia. I'm sorry, it's so long ago. I hope I'll correct that soon, but that's not in my command. But when I was in Australia in 2016, I met with many people with military voices. I was surprised that you'd decided to go for diesel electric and only wished that you could get over the political obstacle that meant that you wouldn't have nuclear propulsion. I'm delighted that you have got over that obstacle, which frankly I put down to Beijing rather than to Canberra. Beijing changed the equation and made it more important that you had that capability, and so I'm glad that you've made that decision. I think it's worth thinking hard though about the French element in this, and it's certainly easy to say that the French are overreacting and that, you know, this is business and it's just what happens and, you know, tough. I think it's worth looking at this from a slightly different perspective as well, though, and remembering who it was and why it was that the French were so keen to sell the Barracuda class to Australia. It wasn't just, I mean, certainly from France's perspective, it wasn't just a submarine sale. It wasn't just about, you know, jobs in South Australia and jobs in Brittany being connected. It was about much more than that from the French perspective. It was about France being an important ally in the Indo-Pacific. It was about France being, you know, a player alongside the United States and Australia. And it was about France sort of, you know, taking its place in the world. And the people who were pushing it, President Macron, the then defense minister, now foreign minister, Le Drian, they were doing it because they're Atlanticists, because they believe in the relationship with the United States, they believe in the relationship with Australia. And so the reason that they have taken it badly and the reason there are no, well, not significant voices on the other side to say, hey, look, we're still friends with Australia and the US, calm down, is because the normal voices who would have said that are the ones who are feeling particularly bruised by this decision. And, you know, like all countries, right, there are, you know, some people in favor, some people against the US, some people in favor, some people against the EU, and so on. And the ones who are now seen to have won, in inverted commas, this debate, who are going around Paris saying, I told you so, are the ones who said, you can never trust the Americans, you can never trust the English or, you know, the British or the Australians. You know, you should be doing this with Europe. There's literally no point in working with these guys. And those who said, no, it's important that France has a voice in the NATO table, France has an important US ally and all the rest of it, they're the ones who are feeling bruised. So this isn't just, I mean, look, of course it's an important contract, but France is a big country, right? I mean, it's not that important a contract. It's an important contract for some parts of Brittany, but it's not going to make or break the French economy. What this is a real kick in the teeth to France's perception of itself and particularly to the Atlanticist wing of French foreign policy. And that's why we need to think really hard about how we bring in France, and by the way, other countries like Japan, Germany, into future cooperation on technology.
Look, I'm really glad to hear you put it like that. And I think just as an aside, as someone who's been quite involved in the Australia-France relationship and indeed efforts to build other arrangements around that, such as Australia, France and India, where we've had a trilateral dialogue. You know, I'm someone who obviously felt a certain pain in the way this has unfolded. I think there's a slight sense of tragedy in this because, of course, you know, we need that partnership with the French just as Australia needs the best submarine capability it can possibly acquire given the really dire strategic circumstances of the Indo-Pacific. So how do we operationalise the, I think the noble way you put that, the idea that we've got to re-engage with the French and other partners, what does that look like in practice?
Well, look, right now that's quite hard. I mean, the French are still asking why you just didn't buy the nuclear version of the Barracuda class, which is the one that they operate. You asked them to downgrade it to diesel electric. They told you it was a bad idea. You said you had to do it for political reasons. They said, if you insist. And then you've turned around and said, well, I want the nuclear version. Slightly surprising to them. I think the conversation that you're having with India is important, and here's the Quad is an important element of that. And by the way, the conversations that you have in the islands is also incredibly important. As you know, France is an important, not just for New Caledonia, but France has got interests in the Pacific that are not dissimilar to your own. And so I think that, you know, engaging them on that conversation is important. I mean, it's worth pointing out that, you know, when I speak to the Indian foreign minister, the relationship he has with France is not the same as the relationship he has with the United Kingdom. And that's not just historic. It's also because Britain has three very strong living bridges in the region. You know, we've got a huge population of Bangladeshi origin, of Indian origin, and of Pakistani origin. And they're all valued, important members of our community. And that means that we have to balance the relationship with those three countries. France doesn't have that connection. France's connections, for historic reasons, are mostly elsewhere. And so France can be much, much less ambiguously pro-Indian. And, you know, the Indians notice that and they feel it. And they see it when they're talking about weapons technology, when they're talking about nuclear cooperation. And so, you know, bringing India and France together as two great democracies and having an Australian voice at the table, I think is an important thing to do, because actually we do need to look at future technology, not just at existing technology. And India's role in that is only going to grow. And having France and Australia and the United Kingdom and the United States working together, I think is an extremely powerful reset against countries that are at the moment using autocracy or autocratic powers in order to develop skills that I think are genuinely threatening.
And we do have still convergent interests in these groupings, whether it's the Quad or AUKUS or other arrangements of democratic powers and middle powers in the Indo-Pacific somehow collaborating. It just looks like it's going to be a difficult road for some time working with the French in that. But I really appreciate the way you've put that, Tom. I want to sort of wrap up really, though, on what AUKUS means and what the British role, the UK role in the Indo-Pacific is likely to look like. Those of us who've followed the dynamics of this region over the last 10 or 20 years have sometimes wondered what role Britain would play. And to be honest, 5 or 10 years ago, we probably did not expect that we'd see Britain re-engaging in the region the way it has. The so-called tilt for the Indo-Pacific that was set out in the integrated review this year. Of course, the carrier strike group in the region at the moment, and topping it all off now, the long-term commitment that is embodied in AUKUS. But what does it actually mean? I mean, how strategic are Britain's interests in the outcome of the contest in the Indo-Pacific between, if you like, China's play for hegemony on the one hand, and on the other hand, either a US-led response or some kind of alignment of middle powers or both. What does Britain actually want in the Indo-Pacific, and can we count on it?
Well, I think, I mean, there's various things that Britain wants. The first is, you know, we don't want autocracies to succeed in bullying democracies. We don't want to see our partners silenced, and we don't want to see freedoms eroded. And that means being present where the challenge is. It means being aware that, you know, countries, not just Australia, but Japan, Indonesia, the Philippines, Taiwan, you know, these are places that matter, and standing up, standing alongside them, standing alongside democracies is important to all of us. But I think it's more than that as well. I mean, Britain's membership of CPTPP, which is now being spoken about very widely here, would really change the economic dynamics of the region for the UK, in the sense that it would link us much more closely. And if you look at the way in which the US trade relationship is going, it seems to me much more likely that the UK will end up with a trade relationship, you know, with a closer trade relationship with the US through CPTPP than bilaterally. Maybe wrong, but certainly the Prime Minister's comments in Washington this morning didn't suggest that there was any immediate chance of a bilateral deal. So let's see whether the Americans come back to the TPP. It's not clear that they will, but there's a possibility. So I think that connects us there. And the last thing that connects us there is, of course, you know, we do have existing commitments, and the Five Parties Defence Agreement, which is, of course, with Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia and Singapore, and the fifth being the United Kingdom. You know, it's mostly a maritime agreement. I mean, in theory, it's more than that, but it's mostly a maritime agreement, and it commits us all to guaranteeing effectively free passage through the South China Seas, the Malacca Straits, and so on. And it's it was what we committed to when we withdrew from East of Suez in the 60s and 70s, and you know, it's still valid, and we still have a commitment there. Now, as we see the Queen Elizabeth, our carrier, sailing through those waters with a complement of US Marine Corps F-35s on board, you know, it's worth remembering that those agreements, that commitment, you know, counts not just for your region, but it counts actually for others as well. I mean, I was speaking to Taro Kano in Japan recently, who's become a very good friend. And, you know, we were talking about the possibility of seeing Japanese F-35s flying off the Queen Elizabeth, because this is one of the things that, bizarrely, that defense inflation costs mean, is that we've all been buying roughly the same kit. You know, 100 years ago, we made our own stuff and it was relatively cheap. These days, you know, a single nut costs £1 million, it seems, as if you buy it off a defence contractor. And so we all end up buying the same ones in order to try and keep the cost down. But that does mean that, you know, for democracies, the interoperability has gone up. And for countries like Australia and the UK, where we are not just interoperable in kit, but in personnel, because we all hold Crown Commissions and therefore have the legal authority to give orders to each other's troops, you know, this does make a very big difference, and it really does change the way in which we operate. So, look, I hope that what this means is we're going to see more regular basing in, you know, Australian ports or New Zealand ports, more frequent visits to some of the island states that, frankly, could do with a bit more support against Chinese pressure. And I hope we're going to see also a greater investment in countries like Indonesia and the Philippines, whose territorial waters are being challenged by an increasingly expansionist Beijing. So I think there's an awful lot that we can do. What we need to see is the commitment. And at the moment, you know, one carrier does not a strategy make. It's great that it's there, but we need to have more enduring commitment if this is to be a summer and not just a swallow.
Thanks, Tom. And before we wrap up, I mean, I think there are big questions there about long-term commitment, about the sustainability of this, you know, about where British interests lie. And I think from an Australian perspective, there's two points I'd close on that I'd love your views on. One is that the hard work actually only begins now. I mean, clearly there was a backstory to the political negotiation and I think the official negotiation of AUKUS where we've got to now. But this is a 20-year or more partnership. And I think in Australia, there's a lot of indrawn breath at the moment, thinking we'd better be serious about this, about developing this capability, particularly the nuclear-powered submarine capability, but the broader relationship as well. But we're three democracies, and democracies have both the blessing and the curse of changing their minds on things from time to time, as we've seen. So what's your sense of what will keep Britain committed in the region and in the relationship to Australia? And I will come back with one last question after that about the dreaded Anglosphere and whether this is the return of that.
So, look, I think the first thing that will keep us committed is family, frankly. I mean, we are very, very closely intermarried, intertwined, interrelated. I can't remember how many Brits there are living in Australia, but I think it's something around a million, and there's a hell of a lot of Aussies living in the UK, and many more, I hope, going to be coming with the new visa arrangements and different ways in which travel is going to be encouraged. As soon as your borders reopen and you're able to fly again, it'd be great to see you. I hope very much that what we're going to see is a deeper relationship from that. I think the second thing, of course, is economics. You know, joining the CPTPP will keep the UK's interests much more South Asian focused or Pacific focused. And then the last thing is, you know, the reality is the world is smaller. You know, we are much more globalized. What happens in your region really matters to us much more than it did, in the 1700s. Volcanoes erupted and we felt the cold for 2 years, but had no real interest in the area. Now, the proverbial butterfly beats its wings and we know about it very quickly. I mean, Evergrande, the Chinese property company that's going through difficulties, has caused a drop in the FTSE 100. I mean, this is an immediate connection, right? And whether you think it's good or bad, I'll leave it to your listeners to decide, but this is an immediate connection that wasn't true a number of years ago. And it's worth remembering that this is something, this is something that we've recognized for a while. And when you look at something like the Five Eyes Alliance, and which is why, which is clearly what AUKUS is to some extent based off, it's worth remembering why it works, because the Five Eyes Alliance isn't like other alliances. It's not an alliance based on, you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. It's not it's not the Musketeer Pact of NATO, all one for all and all for one. It's much more than that. It's a bet not just on our future and yours. It's a bet on our children's and our grandchildren's future, because the level of which we're sharing intelligence means that we need to trust not just your current laws, but actually your culture and the way you raise your kids, that in 100 years' time, you will still keep those secrets. Because if you don't, we may be exposing flanks. And that's what this Ménage à Trois, AUKUS deal is. It's a bet that if we share technology on nuclear propulsion, you're not going to sell it to somebody else in 50 years' time. And that's a bet so far we'd only made with the United States when our nuclear technology went over to Los Alamos in the Second World War. And then when Macmillan renewed the agreement in the 50s, and then, with Polaris and Trident and so on, different kind of nuclear technology, but it's certainly connected. This is a hell of a bet on the future of Australia, and the future of and Australia's bet, by the way, on the future of the UK and the US, because what Australia is now betting is that it will be able to always resupply its ships and or boats rather, and able to sustain them in operation. So that's, you know, you've just made a very big bet. I presume Australia knows what it's doing, but it's made a very big bet on the stability of the United States and the United Kingdom.
And it is important to remember that, you know, the centrality of the United States in this. I think it's been really good to have a conversation that explains, particularly for Australian listeners, the UK role and the UK interests a bit more. But, of course, there's no AUKUS without the United States. And in parallel to this, Australia's done an enormous amount in recent weeks to reaffirm and strengthen the alliance. The so-called AUSMIN meeting in the United States last week stepped up force posture initiatives. And so, you know, if you like, we stand rightly accused of throwing in our lot with America's strategy in the Indo-Pacific. But the last question, Tom, and that is really the flip side of this. One of the accusations, one of the criticisms that will be made of AUKUS is that it is a so-called Anglosphere arrangement, that it's a club of, if you like, countries with Anglo-Saxon traditions, English-speaking. You know, it's an alignment, an alliance in a sense that would be very familiar in the 1940s. What's it doing now? And what about the need to engage with, I guess, a more diverse range of partners with particularly countries that are resident in Asia? How is that read in Britain, or how do you read that, and how do we manage that perception? Is it a problem?
Well, I think, I mean, I'm reminded of what one of your former prime ministers said when I asked them what was the national security strategy of Australia, and their response in three words was, God bless America. Of course, that's a slightly flippant answer to, but it exposes a fundamental truth, which is that, you know, the reality is for democracies that the United States is the hegemon. It is the power around which others, you know, on which others depend. And as the keystone in our security relationship, it's hardly surprising that we all lean towards it. I mean, you know, there are two lessons of the recent AUKUS affair for France and for the UK. For France, one of the lessons could be you need to hang on tighter to the United States, because actually strategic autonomy is a lot more expensive, a lot harder than you thought it was. And that is one reading of what's just happened. You know, and I know what you mean about Anglosphere, although I look at Australia today, okay, 5 years ago in 2016, and, you know, the White Australia policy ended a long time ago. I don't know what the ethnic makeup of Australia is, but it's certainly much more, it looks much more regionally balanced than it did 30, 40 years ago. If you look
to interrupt you, our largest three migrant communities are Indian, Chinese, and British, perhaps not in that order, but that's the big three. So you're absolutely right.
You know, that's a big change. If you look at the United States today, for example, California is now more than 50% Hispanic. Now, you know, the United States has changed. And by the way, the UK has changed too, not quite as dramatically, but it has changed too. You know, what we're actually doing is not an Anglosphere in a narrow sense. What we're doing is a bet on, if you like, the operating system that has built democratic liberty in one of the most effective ways the world has ever seen. Now, I'm not saying there aren't other free democratic countries. There are. But the democratic experiment that has resulted in the liberties that the Australian, British and American people enjoy is remarkably successful. You know, Australian democracy has been flourishing for over a century, British for two or three centuries, depending on how you define it, possibly more, the US for nearly 250 years. You know, these are extraordinary successes in how to live together, how to transfer power, how to settle disputes, how to resolve arguments. That is why we can make this bet on each other. And so I wouldn't look at it as an Anglosphere in the sense of, you know, to use the term in the 1950s, a White Australia policy. I would look at it as an operating system in which, you know, we can work together really effectively. You know, this is Apple plugging into Apple. It's not like Microsoft where you can stick anything in, but none of it really works. This is this is Apple, where it all works together seamlessly, and connecting other things, yeah, it's a bit tricky, but you can, you know. And so it's that's what we're looking at here. So I do think we do need to bring in others, but I think we need to bring in others whose similar commitment to the long-term future of the liberty and democracy of their peoples is something that we can see established. Funnily enough, I think Japan is a country that we should be making that bet with. Germany, another one. France, another one. You know, there are countries around the world we should be doing this. This isn't simply an Anglosphere, but it needs to be based on the operating system, not on the, you know, not on the expedient decision of a day.
That's a really great note to end on, those shared principles of liberal democracy. And it's, I mean, it is striking that the United States, the United Kingdom and Australia are actually three of the most multicultural societies in the world today. So thank you, Tom. Thanks so much for your thoughts and your time, really big picture strategic thinking. And we look forward to seeing you in Australia as soon as the borders open.
Thanks very much. It'll be a great pleasure to be back.
Well, that's it for today. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.